Case number 13-3032, et al., United States of America v. Luis Alberto Munoz-Miranda, also known as David, also known as El Gordo, appellant. Mr. Baer for the appellant, Mr. Romano, appellee.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Douglas Baer, counsel for Mr. Munoz. With me at counsel table is Alita Amato, counsel for Mr. Valderrama. These gentlemen stand convicted of conspiring to distribute a controlled substance on board a vessel that's within the jurisdiction of the United States. On its merits, this case raises novel and questions of first impression of a constitutional and factual nature. The question really on the merits is whether, pursuant to the constitutional grant of authority to define and punish felonies on the high seas, Can Congress authorize the prosecution of every land-based member of a foreign drug trafficking organization without any nexus to the United States, as long as that organization plans or actually uses a vessel without nationality to transport one shipment of drugs?
So before we go to the merits, can we talk a little bit about the consequences of the guilty plea that was entered and whether that resulted in a waiver of the claims? And in particular, if we could divide your argument between the constitutional claims and the statutory claims.
Right.
Because we have our decision in Delgado-Garcia, and the government says that that decision establishes that, as to the constitutional claims at least, those were waived by entry of the guilty plea. And can you start by addressing what your response to that argument would be? Because as I read the decision, it does appear to support the government's submission in that regard.
With all due respect to Judge Santel, that decision, or that part of the decision, is Judge Santel's alone. The concurrence did not agree, and the dissent did not agree on that.
Can I just follow up on that a little bit, just to be precise? So the concurrence definitely didn't follow something, and I guess the question is, what is the something that the concurrence didn't follow? And as I read the claims in that case, there was a constitutional claim about nexus, to the effect that the Fifth Amendment requires an establishment of some nexus. There was also a statutory claim that said that under the presumption against extraterritoriality, the statute just doesn't reach the conduct. And the concurrence seemed to be saying that we didn't need to reach whether the statutory claim was waived. But I guess it didn't look self-evident from the concurrence that the concurrence meant also to say that we didn't need to reach whether the constitutional claim had been waived. So I don't know that there was a disagreement as between the writing judge and the concurring judge on the constitutional claims. But if you think otherwise, can you please explain?
I'll beg to differ and leave it at that. That was my reading of it. Perhaps I didn't parse it as closely as Your Honor, but it was certainly my sense from the and in fact, the government in its footnote did note that it appeared to be the decision of only one judge.
I thought the government's footnote, though, spoke particularly about the statutory claims. We can ask the government, but I thought they were drawing the same distinction that I'm drawing.
Where would you like me to start, on the statutory or the constitutional?
I guess what I'd like you to start with is, do you have a response on the waiver of the constitutional claims other than to disagree? Because if there's a reason to disagree, then I'd love to hear it. But
there are in fact, I think, two bases on which the court could choose not to enforce the waiver. The courts have identified at least two instances where a waiver cannot be made, and that is to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court and where the issues relate to the defendant not being hailed into court. Now, I realize that the Delgado decision seems to say that you really can't challenge subject matter jurisdiction because it's a federal crime, and every federal crime is within the jurisdiction of the district court. If that's the case, then I don't understand where the case law comes from that says that subject matter jurisdiction could be challenged, because it seems to be a tautology that if you're indicted, then that's within the subject matter of the court.
Isn't there more than one way? In fact, the Supreme Court has said there's too many ways to define in which jurisdiction is used. And as I understand the position of the government, in this case and on this subject, the statutory use of the term jurisdiction in the United States refers to the jurisdiction of the Congress and the President to regulate an area which does not inherently go to the subject matter of the court. subject matter jurisdiction of the court. So that what they're saying is the question of whether the acts here come within the ambit of the statute is a matter of merits decision, not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. The court has jurisdiction to determine whether or not that makes out an offense within the ambit of the statute. Do you understand?
That is their argument. I think our counterargument is that these defendants, residents of Colombia, with no association with the United States at all, who are not, unlike others, presumptively within the jurisdiction of the federal courts. They're not in the United States. They were never in the United States. They are not American citizens. The acts they're alleged to have committed did not occur here. There is no nexus with their illegal activity with the United States, that these individuals, the only ability that the government has to bring them before a court in the first place is whether they were associated with a vessel subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And I think
that brings us back to the question of whether jurisdiction is used in two different senses, the one being the regulatory jurisdiction or legislative jurisdiction, if you would, our executive jurisdiction, the other being the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. And the Morrison case, which I understand is a totally different statute, different context, but Morrison and the two that said it say that the question of within the ambit of the statute or within the ambit of the regulatory jurisdiction is a merits question, not a question of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, let me say, if it were clean slate, I honestly think you'd have a very good argument that it's subject matter jurisdiction, but isn't Morrison, if not controlling, it's at least compelling toward the opposite view.
But when we look at the statute says this is a legal question subject to a decision by the judge. It's not a fact question that would be cited by the jury. It's not an element of the offense. It goes to whether this court or the district court can adjudicate the case. If the boat is not within the subject matter, or within the jurisdiction of the United States, and the statute speaks to both jurisdiction and venue. And in a similar way that both the Code of Federal, the criminal, federal criminal law and the federal civil law speak to the jurisdictions of the court and the venues that are appropriate within
it. How does venue help you, Annie? Because venue certainly is a question of merits, and it certainly is waivable. Is that not, are those both not true states?
That's true, but I'm trying to draw you on
appeal. There is a waiver of appeal in the criminal, the guilty plea proceedings below, is there not? This is a waived, your client entered a waiver, right?
He did.
And I understand your position, the subject matter jurisdiction would not be waivable, and as I say, it has a compelling force behind it. But venue is waivable, is it not?
No, we're not challenging venue, Your Honor. I was just pointing out that the juxtaposition of those two issues is similar to the discussions in both the federal criminal law and the federal civil laws. The second basis, though, which we address in our brief and I think is probably perhaps more applicable here, is the fact that the court does not have to enforce a waiver. A waiver does not bar the court's review. We know that clearly even from the Delgado case because the court held or ruled that if the government doesn't raise the waiver, the court then should address the merits. So it's not a bar. The question then becomes whether the court should enforce the waiver or not. If the government doesn't raise it, this court has indicated it will not enforce it. We believe there are other situations, in this case a matter of fundamental fairness, where the court should not enforce the waiver. There's a complete record for review. The court has an extensive opinion by the district court on these issues. The facts have been stipulated.
I'm not sure where you get that principle from, because as I read the decisions, there's two types of claims that fall outside the notion that a guilty plea waives claims for purposes of appeal. One is subject matter jurisdiction, and the other is the Blackledge line of decisions for where the argument is you can't be hailed to court in the first place. Are you suggesting that there's a third one?
Yes. And we discuss it in our brief. There are cases that say, and I think Judge Torella in in one of his dissenting opinions, in Cardales-Luna, which is at 632 Fed 3rd 371, notes that there are some constitutional questions that should lead the court to exercise its discretion to hear them, whether under other circumstances they might not. And there are other cases, I think, that we've cited in our brief that propose the same thought. These are unique facts. These defendants, I mean, Mr. Munoz lived in Medellin. He lived roughly 500 miles from the ocean, 512 miles from international waters. His only reason for being here is his indictment under this statute. And we submit that as a matter of fundamental fairness, the court should review it. The second reason is there are other cases, one pending before this court, one, I understand, in the district court, and probably more that the government has brought and will bring. And the fundamental question is, can the United States drag people out of their own countries for acts that they committed in those countries that have no nexus to this country? Can Congress authorize that even though they are not felonies committed on the high seas? And we submit that for the future protection of these foreign nationals and for the future guidance of the government, the court should address it. And that leads then to the third.
But what's the government getting out of a plea arrangement then in that context? Because the decision to enter into a guilty plea affords advantages to both sides. And if there's this exception that says, well, when there's an important issue that might arise in other cases, and therefore it's in the interest of everybody to litigate that claim on appeal and have a resolution of it, then doesn't that have the effect of undoing the advantage to the government of the plea arrangement in the first place, which is that you get some advantage out of this, we're getting some advantage out of this, which is finality, and we're all going to go home. Now, everybody understands that there's this backdrop that there's subject matter jurisdiction exception, and then there's also an exception for the Blackledge line of cases. But if there's kind of an ad hoc exception for circumstances in which, as a matter of fairness and because there's other cases in the line, we ought to address the issue, then it seems like it's a difficult backdrop against which to enter into plea negotiations, because the government can't ever be sure that there's actually going to be finality. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument. But.
No, that's a correct perception of the argument. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have finality in that case, but I think it's the unique case that the court would in fact address the merits. Now, the court could find, as we have argued, that the Blackledge line of cases, by analogy, applies here as well, because again, these are individuals who would not be before the court but for the exercise of this statute. And again, they're not presumptively subject to the jurisdiction of the United States because they weren't here in the first place. It's not a question of picking somebody up off the street, putting them back on the street, and having them litigate. These guys were arrested. They were incarcerated. They were brought here, incarcerated while they were here, solely for the purposes of this situation.
Explain to me, how are you applying the Blackledge exception?
Analogy.
Very, very loosely, and I'm not following you. What are you saying is the applicable aspect of the Blackledge exception, if it applies?
Blackledge said that we won't allow a waiver,
right,
to prevent someone from arguing that they shouldn't have been brought into court,
right,
in the first place.
Okay.
In that case, it was a double jeopardy issue. And the defendant said, well, they shouldn't have brought me into court because it constituted double
right.
jeopardy.
So how does that apply here? You're going back and forth between as applied and facial lack of authority on the part of the government. I'm not sure what you're arguing. On the one hand, you're arguing that, well, in these circumstances, these guys can't be convicted because they're not satisfying the requirements of the statute. And then on the other hand, you seem to be arguing the government has no power to regulate at all in these areas. And I'm not sure which way you're going and how does that fit with you can't be hailed into court.
In a case that implicates foreign relations, I think if the government has no power, then these defendants can't be brought before.
Now, is that your argument?
That is my argument
that
on this particular point.
That this statute is facially unconstitutional. It can't exist.
The conspiracy provision cannot exist except in the context of on the high seas.
Well, then that's an as applied.
Yes.
Blackledge doesn't go there, does it?
Doesn't go quite that far.
No, it doesn't. Okay. All right.
But it did require a review of the facts in order to demonstrate that there was double jeopardy. It wasn't an attack on just the words in the complaint, as I recall it, or the indictment. It was whether that charge was barred by the due process clause, which incorporated the double jeopardy clause. In this case, what we're arguing is that the limitation on constitutional limitation of power prevents this case from going forward. I think I've used up my 15 minutes, but I'm glad to answer any other questions.
Okay, we'll give you some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Alex Romano on behalf of the United States. The defendants waived all of their claims by pleading guilty, as the questioning of my opponent.
It wasn't just by pleading guilty. It was an express waiver in this case, right?
Your Honor, I think the unconditional guilty plea, I think the law of the circuit is that an unconditional guilty plea in and of itself affects a waiver, except for those two exceptions. It was compounded here by the waiver provisions in the plea agreements where, for example, they waived their right to appeal the district court's final appeal.
Expressly waived the right to appeal even subject matter.
So I do think it is compounded, but I do think the settled rule is that an unconditional guilty plea that is knowing and intelligent weighs all the defendant's claims on appeal, except for claims challenging the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
But do you think that if there was the fact that there's an express waiver here, in addition to the unconditional guilty plea, does that advance the ball for you? In other words, can you expressly waive your entitlement to raise subject matter jurisdiction?
We're not taking the position that that an express clause would waive the subject matter jurisdiction.
I want to make sure I may be repetitious, but you're not taking the position that subject matter jurisdiction can be waived even in an express waiver.
Is correct, Your Honor. We are not taking that position.
Okay, good. Thank you. Position, however, is that this is not subject matter jurisdiction.
That's correct, and I'm prepared to both address the waiver as to both the constitutional claims and the statutory claims. As to the constitutional claims, I think the due process nexus claim is clearly controlled by Delgado Garcia, where we do think a majority of the court did find that the unconditional guilty plea waived what was essentially almost an identical claim that the defendants are raising here. As to the Article I challenge, the claim that the defendants are making that Congress lacked authority to criminalize their conspiratorial conduct in this case doesn't challenge the court's subject matter jurisdiction. It does not fall within the Blackledge-Mena exception. We view that exception as fairly narrow, as where, for example, the mere initiation of the criminal proceeding, where on its face it would be constitutionally suspect, as where you have the face of the indictment indicates that the prosecution would violate double jeopardy.
So, what else other than double jeopardy? I'm not sure what scope you give Blackledge other than double jeopardy.
The only other thing would be in the Blackledge case itself, I believe, was a claim of vindictive prosecution, and then the Mena case was a case of double jeopardy. So those are the only two instances that I'm aware of that would fall within that exception, and that's not what you have here with the Article 1.
Wait, let me make sure. In your imagination, there is no other situation in which Blackledge would ever apply.
Your Honor, as I read Delgado Garcia, it certainly discusses those two instances. I can't conceive of one, and certainly the Article I challenge, the as-applied Article I challenge, doesn't satisfy it. I believe some courts outside this circuit, perhaps in some of the cases cited by my opponent on pages 2 to 3 of their brief, have applied Blackledge-Mena to a facial challenge on vagueness grounds to a statute. I don't believe this court has addressed that circumstance yet, but that might be one conceivable instance.
Suppose the charge was that these guys committed assault in Colombia. Does Blackledge apply?
And the claim is whether Congress could punish that?
Yeah.
I don't believe it does. I mean, that would essentially be a challenge to Congress's authority to pass the statute.
Federal courts have authority to handle criminal assault cases committed in Colombia?
All things being equal, Your Honor, I don't think they do without more.
Well,
for example, here you have
equal.
The.
We don't have that authority, right?
But in terms of
Blackledge, right?
Well, Blackledge goes to that was a claim
cannot
of,
be hailed into court. I'm trying to understand what is that idea. I can't be hailed into court for an alleged crime committed in Colombia.
Your Honor, but
is that right?
I think it has to. You have to come into court to litigate it. The statute has a statutes generally have a presumption of validity, so you need, still need to come into court to litigate that question. So for that reason, I don't think it would come within.
Didn't you? But the people in Blackledge had to come into court to litigate the question
right.
too.
Again, Your Honor, but
this is a really extreme position you're taking. That's why I'm perplexed.
Your Honor, I don't
you're
mean
giving
to take
Blackledge no meaning.
An
I
extreme.
Do you honestly mean? Of course, they had to come into court in Blackledge, as my colleague has mentioned. So that can't be the answer. That you have to come into court to say I shouldn't be in court.
Your Honor,
that's what this
I'd just
whole
like
thing
to make
is
the
about.
Point that I think
Wait,
it's a fairly
Take this example. I was trying to think of one that I thought would be pretty straightforward and easy. I know the U.S. attorney don't like to concede anything, but the charge is, and the government gets up and says, that's all we're charging, is that he committed assault in the streets of Colombia. And that's on the face of the indictment. All your briefings say that. Blackledge wouldn't throw that out?
If, Your Honor, if there's a law in the books that on its face would apply to that situation, then it becomes a question of whether Congress could enact that, has the power to pass that statute. And, you know, I think this court in Albo.
Are there at least some courts of appeals that have said that that situation where, let's hypothesize that there is a statute that says assaults everywhere in the world are a violation of United States law under Title 18, and then somebody brings that prosecution and it comes before us. Would we at least be faced with other jurisdictions that have held that would fall within the Blackledge?
I believe, Your Honor, that some of the cases cited in my opponents would probably be from out of circuit would apply Blackledge Lena to a challenge to whether Congress has authority to enact a statute. But I don't read the law of the circuit to apply Blackledge Lena to that situation. And I would also rely on the Al-Balul case.
There's an interesting question in the hypotheticals we're talking about now. Is I'm not sure, how does the court have the authority to pursue or allow such a claim to be pursued in our doors? I mean, where is our authority coming from? On a criminal charge that everyone agrees has nothing more or less to do than with.
The jurisdiction would, of course, be under the statute 3231, and if it charges an offense against the United States,
well, see,
then the question is whether.
Because we're merging questions, because we would have to look and say Congress has no such authority, and we certainly have no such authority to try cases that involve criminal charges in Colombia.
Your Honor.
I'm not sure what Blackledge means, and if you can't concede that case, then I'm totally perplexed. What is the Supreme Court talking about?
I would also fall back on the Baucom case, which is one of the first cases in the trio that lead up to Delgado-Garcia, which cautions against treating facial challenges to a statute as non-waivable.
But
didn't allow every instance. I will agree with
and
that.
And also, I think it specifically dealt with subject matter jurisdiction.
Right.
So
it's not a matter of
facial constitutionality doesn't go to subject matter jurisdiction. I think the question is whether facial constitutionality goes to Blackledge, which, and I think Baucom specifically carved that out. I mean, it viewed as, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it said that Blackledge is relevant to this, and so as salient, and so it spoke to it.
It did speak to
but
it.
But it didn't suggest, I don't think, that a facial constitutional attack of the kind that Judge Edwards is talking about falls outside of the Blackledge.
It didn't decide that question. Your Honor, correct. I would also point just to the Al-Balul case and just reiterate as well that we don't have a facial challenge here. I think that's clear from my opponent's reply brief that it was an as-applied challenge. But in Al-Balul, which involved an ex post facto challenge to a statute, the court indicates in footnote 6 that that claim is non-jurisdictional. And they also cite to Delgado-Garcia's discussion of the Blackledge Mena.
Which also wasn't a facial challenge, though, or was it?
In Al-Balul, I know it involved an as-applied. I'm not sure if it was also a facial, but it was certainly an as-applied in there. But we do think that that's just further support for our position that waivability is established.
Can I ask you about the statutory claims? Sure. Yeah. So unless it's further on the constitutional ones. So the statutory claim, the one about the jurisdiction over the vessel, the Congress says that jurisdiction of the United States with respect to a vessel subject to this chapter is not an element of an offense. And then it says that it's a preliminary question of law to be determined solely by the trial judge. And
that's
then it pairs it with venue. And it's definitely true that venue is waivable in a way that subject matter jurisdiction is not. But by pairing it with venue, I think the point maybe your opponent is making is that venue also goes to which court an action is supposed to be in. Subject matter jurisdiction, unlike legislative jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction goes to whether the case can come before the court. And so by pairing those two things together and by saying it's not an element of an offense and by saying it's a preliminary issue to be resolved by the judge, Congress gave a lot of indications that it thought that the jurisdiction of the U.S. with respect to a vessel is in fact going to be treated as subject matter jurisdiction here.
I don't think that gets past the Supreme Court's admonition in Arbog, which I think really makes clear that if Congress wants to specify in a statute a limitation on the court's subject matter jurisdiction, it has to do so clearly. And the examples that the court cited in Arbog of statutes that clearly do that all involve statutes that refer to the district, the jurisdiction of the district court.
And the problem for you with the Arbog argument, it looked like a clear black-letter test. I mean, you know what I'm trying to say.
Right.
But in any event, the subsequent case law in the Supreme Court has tempered that. And there are later cases that say, yes, that it's there, but it's not quite as clear as we were saying.
This
looks like a fairly strong statutory provision.
Your Honor, I think the First Circuit, the circuits are divided on this question.
Right.
And we, in our brief, obviously have argued the position adopted by the First Circuit in Gonzalez. But I think there's a lot of merit to that decision, which is that the reference to subject to the jurisdiction of the United States is to really the substantive reach of the statute that applies to some vessels but not others.
So it definitely could be. There's no doubt that it could be. If you just think of the abstract about what jurisdiction of the United States with respect to a vessel, what you would suppose Congress would do with that, I think you would probably suppose that it's legislative jurisdiction and not subject matter jurisdiction. But what gives force to the other side's argument on this is the way that that particular locution is used in the context of this statute.
Well, Your Honor, it was not always decided by this question of whether the vessel was subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. This is discussed in the Gonzalez opinion. That was the result of an amendment to the statute in 1996. So it used
right.
to go to a jury. And the First Circuit looked at the legislative petition. They said, there's nothing in passing that amendment that indicated that Congress was making this a question of the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
I
would also point to
we want to go into international law, but if it weren't for that jurisdiction over the vessel, how would there be legislative jurisdiction? How would the United States as a government have any jurisdiction to say anything about it? It's any more about the conduct charged here than the assault that my colleague was asking you about.
Right. Well, and I think the First Circuit looked at that and said that really goes to is sort of a loose reference to Congress's authority to step in and regulate not to a court.
If they hadn't put this amendment, how could the statute even be constitutional in extraterritorial reach without this language amendment?
Right, Your Honor,
I'm referring to the
making it
you talked about. They have to have that language about the abode over a ship over which the United States has jurisdiction.
That's
in order to make this a constitutional extraterritorial application.
Right, and that's a question of.
I mean, domestic law adopts international law, and there's only about five bases for jurisdiction beyond your borders, and you don't have one unless you have the high seas or the other methods
right.
of having jurisdiction over the ship.
And that's a question of Congress's authority to regulate, which courts routinely decide. So we don't view that as stripping or going to a court's subject matter jurisdiction. And there is a contrast in language.
Maybe I'm not following what you're saying, because even if it was a question of subject matter jurisdiction, it's still something that has to be found in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So you would still satisfy the predicate that in order to have a constitutional reach, if you think that this is a necessary precondition to a constitutional application, you would still have that satisfied. It's just that it would be satisfied as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
It would be both, right? Well, it would be whether it's, subject matter jurisdiction question is whether it charges an offense against the United States. The question for Congress's authority is whether it's proper under the High Seas Clause. I'm happy to address the merits of the statelessness question if the court would like.
The waiver is very important to your position in this case, right?
Your Honor, we're...
Without the waiver, you might have some misgivings.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. We stand by our arguments on the merits, and I'm prepared to address any of the issues on the merits if the court would like.
I would like to hear a little bit on the merits on this question. If insofar as... let's just engage in the hypothetical that this goes to subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay.
I take your point that it may not, and there's definitely some force to your argument. But if it does go to subject matter jurisdiction, then it can be raised, you would acknowledge, at this
right.
stage, and we'd have to resolve it. And on that, I'm curious as to why it seemed to me you didn't rely as much as you might have on the predicate statement in the joint statement of stipulated facts that both defendants signed on to, which is just this predicate statement that says the defendant was a co-conspirator in a drug trafficking organization. I'm looking at JA-128 for one of them. A drug trafficking organization which, from in or about 2006 and continuing until August 25, 2010, transported narcotics from Colombia on stateless go-fast vessels through international waters to other countries. And then in particular, and then talking about the particular allegations involved with respect to each of the defendants in their respective statements. But just that predicate statement alone tells you that the conspiracy dealt with stateless vessels that travel through international waters?
Yes, Ron. My understanding of our brief is that we did rely on that statement, and we do think that that statement is sufficient on the question of statelessness. That is an admission that they were involved in a conspiracy that used stateless vessels to travel on the high seas.
We could still leave us in the question as to whether the jurisdiction of the United States extended to purely domestic activities in another country, although those activities might have implications beyond there in a conspiracy on the high seas, but it does not answer the question as to whether that jurisdiction is
extended. Your Honor, as to the other statutory question, as to the extraterritorial reach of the statute, mm-hmm. I would agree that statement would not resolve mm-hmm. the question of the statute's extraterritorial mm-hmm. reach. And I'm prepared to make some arguments there. I see that my time has expired.
No, just to understand the architecture of your argument. So there's two potential statutory arguments that the other side is raising, as I understand
right.
it. One is that there's no jurisdiction with respect to the vessel.
Right.
The other is that the statute doesn't reach extraterritoriality to the kind of conduct that I'm alleged to have committed because I didn't engage in that conduct on the vessel.
Exactly.
Now, as to the former of those, if that turns out to be a matter of subject matter jurisdiction under the statute, you have to go to the merits. And on the
that's
merits
correct.
Of that, I guess that's where I was trying to suggest that this sentence could have a good deal of silence. But that doesn't answer the question that Judge Santel is raising, which is the second one about extraterritoriality.
Right, which is less record-based and more of a question of statutory interpretation. And for all the reasons that we've argued in our brief, we do think that the conspiracy provision should be applied to land-based conspirators outside the territorial jurisdiction of the United States.
Okay.
And I ask the Court respectfully to affirm the convictions. Thank you.
Thanks. Does Mr. Baer have any time? Well, Mr. Baer, we'll give you 2 minutes.
To address the question that the Court just posed about the introductory language into the stipulation,
yeah.
I would just point out that we read, of course, the third paragraph as being a limitation on the second because the way the third paragraph, at least in Mr. Munoz's stipulated facts, starts off is, had the defendant proceeded to trial, the government's evidence would have shown. So this is the evidence which the government says provides a factual basis for the statement in paragraph 2. And in the case of Mr. Munoz, the only thing he admits to in particular is that he was involved with a shipment of drugs that never made it onto a boat, a boat that never made it into the water, apparently, or maybe was sitting at a dock, and there certainly didn't make it into international waters. In terms of Mr.
Where is Mr. Munoz's stipulation? That's JA
93.
Okay. So as to that one, again, it seems to me there's two statutory arguments you're making. One is the vessel-based argument that the jurisdiction of the U.S. doesn't reach this vessel. The other is the extraterritoriality argument, which says that the stuff that he's alleged to have committed doesn't come within the compass of the statute. And as to the former of those, the vessel one, why doesn't this one sentence at least establish that that one is satisfied? I get that you have a further argument that says the reach of the statute doesn't get to my client's conduct. And you could argue that, well, this statement doesn't get you all, doesn't get the government all the way home as to that. But as to jurisdiction over the vessel, why doesn't the statement get the government home, since it says that the conspiracy relied on stateless vessels through international waters, which, as I read it, does satisfy the statutory element?
Well, what it says is it doesn't we're talking about paragraph 2, just so that I'm clear, right?
Well, the sentence is in paragraph 3 on JA 3. So the sentence would be that the conspiracy transported narcotics from Colombia on stateless go-fast vessels through international waters to other countries in particular, and then it goes on to talk about the specific ship that you're rightly focused on with respect to Mr. Munoz. But why don't we assume that that's a ship that is stateless and that was going to go through international waters, which then at least would deal with the vessel part of your statutory argument, although I take your point that it would leave open the question about whether the statute reaches the conduct that your client engaged in as opposed to the vessel.
The first interesting point to note is that the government doesn't use the language of the statute. It doesn't say this is an unflagged vessel, a vessel not registered in the United States. It's a stateless vessel. That's an undefined word. So how does the district court understand what that means? It understands it by the basis of what comes next.
But doesn't the statute say vessel without nationality?
It does. And that's
what's the difference between a vessel without nationality and a stateless vessel?
I don't know, because I'm not sure what a stateless vessel is. A vessel without nationality is defined in the statute. The government knows how to use the statutory language, the statutory evidence, and the statutory language, and they chose not to do it. They said stateless. Now, the district court judge has to find that there are facts sufficient to demonstrate that he was, in fact, a co-conspirator in a drug trafficking organization. And the only facts that she has, the particular facts that she had before her, are the facts that come in the next sentence. And those facts we submit, both for Mr. Valderrama and Mr. Munoz, don't establish a factual basis upon which she could accept a plea of guilty to this particular statute. We've always believed, and we've argued in our briefs, that the statute has to be read in light of the constitutional grant of authority to Congress. And in this case, as I said, if this prosecution is accurate, these facts are sufficient, then the government of the United States could prosecute the people who were going to load the boat, the guy who drove the truck with the drugs, the people who manufactured those drugs, the people who grew those drugs, as well as the lieutenants and the captains and the leaders of this organization. And I submit that Congress doesn't have that authority. And I think this case lays it out pretty clearly. The court has no further questions, though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Baer, you were appointed by the court in this matter to represent the appellants.
I was, Your Honor, so was Ms. Alito.
The court thanks you for your able assistance with this matter.